to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
You're drowning and I throw you a life jacket. Would you grab it? Yes, good. Pick up 200 shares. I won't let you down.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
Ask them how they'd like to see 30, 40% returns. What are they going to say? No? I don't want to see those returns.
Where's the money, Lebowski?
You're going to make a lot of money, right?
Be aggressive. Learn how to push.
Show him a 3% return, and I'll trust you to watch his kids for the weekend.
I'm a big fan of money.
Move around. Motion creates emotion.
I did not know that.
That's it. I'm done.
Low and Wolfpack, Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tomorrow Ricky on the board. SP Futures up 17. NASDAQ Futures up 106. We continue to do record after record every day as we, I'm looking at the, well, first of all, we have Professor Carl.
You do.
How are you, bud?
Well, you know, I get up this morning, I pull myself an espresso, get ready to, you know, do my usual day kind of things. And although it's still hotter than hell here, we're supposed to get a little bit of pattern change out of that in the next 2 or 3 days, though. So this
yeah,
may
so
be
the
last. Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because the local media has now taken to adding AI to everything that they post on social media. Okay, so it's like, so now we have one of the local news places that puts their stuff on Nextdoor. And that's fine. But then they add a comment to their own post, which is AI generated, which is one of those, well, how do you feel about, you know, da da da. And this one's, well, how do you feel about the climate change that's impact, you know, that's the cause of it? So I put a nice little post up. I said, excuse me. The reason we've had this different weather pattern this summer is because the ENSO is currently neutral, and that is relatively uncommon, but not unprecedented by a stretch of the imagination. The ENSO being neutral alters the path of the jet stream, and that in turn changes the weather pattern. Now, the good news is if you happen to live on the Gulf Coast, the ENSO being neutral, because it alters the jet stream, also alters the genesis, or in this case, the lack thereof, of hurricanes.
Yep. Well.
So I mean, if you don't
yin
like
yang.
Well, if you don't like hurricanes, then you know, not too many people do like hurricanes. Then a neutral ENSO is actually one of your best friends because it plays hell with the organization and the swirl that, of course, a hurricane has to have, right? So yeah. So there's a yang to go with the yang. And I got a whole bunch of likes on that. Nobody wanted to come at me and challenge it because it's, I mean, you really can't argue it. The other thing that's interesting is that in the, you know, a lot of people are simply not old enough. But in the 1970s, in the mid-1970s, towards the latter back half, like 77, 78, 77 in particular, was a year with a neutral ENSO in the summer, very much like this year. And we vacationed in Tennessee a lot when I was a kid, and it was hotter than hell here. Okay? So, I mean, you know, right? It was also hotter than hell, you know, all over the Midwest. I mean, it wasn't just Tennessee. Yeah, because that's, you know, that's the pattern it produces. But this change is rather interesting too, because the front that is causing it is likely to get all the way to the Gulf. Now, that almost never happens in the summer, and again, it's because of the neutral ENSO that you're going to see that. So that's, you know, I mean, that's what's causing this. Okay.
Well, I think the issue here is, I mean, you know, of course, you'll talk to people and they're like, it's always hot in Chicago in the summertime. It can be. It is. But the thing I find very unusual about this, and again, I'm not digging through the numbers like you are, is most people, and again, it's a broad generalization, most people can handle and are prepared for hot days.
Right.
But this, we've been getting, it's so humid, it's getting to like 82, 83 at night, and that's what If you don't have air, you're screwed. I mean, because
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is that perturbation of the jet, that it doesn't buckle like it normally does. Normally, the jet has kind of an oscillatory kind of look to it. Okay, and it goes further south in the wintertime, and it stays further north, typically in Canada in the summer. But the neutral ENSO tends to flatten that. And so that's why you get what you're getting, which is, because normally what happens is you get very hot weather, it's summer, but then a front comes through, you get a storm, it cools it off, it brings some cold air down from the Arctic, and then...
We've been raining every day, and then it gets just as hot. It's like we're in Miami.
Right, but that's the thing, is that pattern has been of those kind of flushes that normally come through gets disrupted when this happens. So you get what you're getting, which is it's hot as hell. The humidity does not get flushed out because that air mass doesn't get flushed out. You get these heat dome kinds of things. And, it sucks. It does.
I live, I'm going to say about a mile from the lake. When I first... Yeah. There's been years where every night, no matter how hot it is during the day, you almost could go without your air at night because you get a little bit of a lake breeze. there isn't a hint of that this summer. Not a hint.
Oh yeah. Well, it's all part of the same thing. Okay. But that's the cause of it, and it's different. It is what it is. Now they're saying, it was funny because like this pattern was noted as we were coming out of the winter, and it's one of the reasons that this spring around here was in the early summer was so stupidly wet because we kept getting these storms that were coming.
We were cool.
Well, we were getting soaked. All right, because we'd get these storms that would just sit on top of us and dump water. Same thing, with what happened down in Texas, right? And so, but again, that's that's.
We've had a couple of those local deals here a few weeks ago. They were talking about, it rained by me, but I'm 2 miles away.
Right.
They were saying there were 4 inches, like at the United Center, and all the.
Oh yeah.
And I saw all of a sudden, there's a whole bunch of, if you look at Chicago rain totals, there's rain gauges all over the place, right? So I start out at O'Hare moving toward the United Center. It's like half inch, 0.7, 0.9, 1.5, and right where the middle of it was like 4.2.
Yeah.
And like a mile away, it was, 2. It was unbelievable.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I don't know if you heard the news yesterday. I was having a good time last night. Dr. J, John and Jerry was in town. We went out to dinner, had a nice time, and
nice.
At least for a while. And then remember the one of the greatest leading lines of any poem ever. There is no joy in Mudville.
Yep.
Remember Ryan Sandberg died. That hit home. Boy, that hit home because I watched the guy the whole way, watched him come up. Nicest guy ever. And by the way, when was that? What's that poem? There is no joy in Mudville.
Mighty Casey has struck out.
Ernest Thayer. Was it 1890 or something? The San Francisco Chronicle. Mighty Casey. But guess who wrote Casey's Revenge?
No.
Who was... God, I start the story and I forget the name. Who wrote the Four Horsemen in Notre Dame? What the hell is his name? He very, very famous guy. I'll dig that up. I should know that.
What's the name of the book?
Grantland Rice. Remember that name, Grantland Rice?
No.
He wrote. He was the most prolific sports writer. He's the one who run the the Four Horsemen of Notre Dame. Was it Pestilence something something something? They had the Irish backfield on the horses. That was Rackney's team. The backfield was known as the Four Horsemen. Check that out, Ricky. Four Horsemen Notre Dame. I'm positive it was Greenland Rice. But that one hit home. Hey, just when my clients, I guess, think I'm a genius, although our gold kind of came back down a little bit, and everybody thinks they're a genius in the market.
Sorry, just real quick, Grantland Rice?
Yeah.
Is that what you were thinking of?
Yeah. He also wrote Casey's Revenge. Casey came back in that team a couple weeks later and did hit the home run.
Well, there you go.
There you go. Does everybody know that we're up to the last month? Now, I won't say these idiots. I'll say these new statisticians that give you the yearly stuff. Pull bleep on that. It's this month times 12.
Right.
Yeah. Well, this money supply growth in June. This is why I don't really get, other than, you know, the guy being the ultimate big mouth showman. I don't get this fight between Trump and Powell. Powell's doing exactly what he wants him to do.
Well, of course he is. But, you know, Chief, this is, look, this is all a stage show, all right, when you get down to it, all right? Inflation is always, Friedman, always an everywhere monetary phenomenon, right? Which, by the way, is true. But as I pointed out, when we did this, we have enjoyed, you know, everyone says, well, the United States is, you know, we have seigniorage and our ability to exploit that is superior to everybody else's, and this, you know, yada 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 yada. No.
Kevin just wrote in, this was outlined against a blue-gray October sky. The Four Horsemen rode again.
There you go.
Kevin says, you don't get that kind of writing anymore.
No, you don't.
And never will with AI.
You don't need to because of AI, right? Exactly.
Yeah, except I don't think AI has Grantland Rice's imagination.
No, you just but you don't have to be able to think. That's what's done. It's.
But isn't that thinking. What we're supposed to? Who was the
chief? Oh, chief, come on! You're such an old school fuddy duddy. I mean,
who was the
philosopher
that said, "I think, therefore I am"?
Yeah. Well,
who was it? I'm going blank. I was not a clever philosophy guy. But anyway. I got the last month's money supply multiplied times 12. It's 7.5%.
Yeah.
What are these guys thinking? I know we have this alleged, dominant currency, but are they trying to push it to the limit where it breaks or what?
Chief, the federal budget deficit as a percentage of GDP is just shy of 7. And has been for the last few years.
And we're not in a war.
Well, again, I mean, years ago, many, many years ago, when I first started writing my column, and in fact, one of the things that I think I referenced in Leverage, I'd have to go look, is that if you wanted to actually address some of this BS, one of the ways to do it would be to have a constitutional amendment that says that only in the case of a declared war may you run a budget deficit.
How would you expect the guys that are doing this now ever to have a constitutional amendment like that?
Well, obviously it's not going to happen because it means you can't hand out, so-called free, you can't do Obama phones. You can't do, freebies for this or that or whoever. Or by the way, whoever's getting it under the desk, which has no benefit to anybody except them.
Well, I mean, it
that seems to, and that it, seems it, to it happen spins. An awful lot. Well, but that seems to happen an awful lot, right? I mean,
Well, I mean, we could have a whole show on this, but you could make. I'm going to say that people have always been people, right? And
right.
I think if you and I made PT boat engines, even with guys like Harry Truman looking in our underwear to make sure we didn't screw the government. Let's say we screwed them a little bit, 5%,
right,
and or 10%, and we got our PT boat engine on the south side of Chicago. All of us lived in the south side of Chicago, and the extra 10%, some went to some bonuses, some went to the local saloons. It flowed right back. In some of that flowed right back in taxes right to the government. You sort of kept it in the family to a certain extent, and that's why now this multinational stuff, they don't care where that money goes. I don't think the names of the people, every time the guy gets up from NVIDIA, I don't think his dedication to America is, and I don't know the guy personally, so I shouldn't probably say something like this. I don't think dedication to America is on number one on his list. He's our generation's Harold Janine, and where Harold Janine thought governments were just a bunch of schmoes you had to play with, right? And he was a ITT, the first big conglomerate.
Yeah.
I mean, this money is, It's like Milton Friedman. If you give this word today, the guy sounds like an idiot. But the time was different. Somebody asked him, what do you think about national debt? He goes, I don't even worry about it. And the guy says, what are you talking about? He says, it's like the wife owing the husband money. The house is flat. But he came from an era where it was World War II. You borrowed money from your citizenry with every intention of paying it back. And if you didn't, it wasn't the best thing, but still. But now it's not the way it is. I mean, it's owned by other people, that all of a sudden it's political issues. Hey, did you ever...
Here's the thing. We had, so for a long period of time, as global, and really Clinton sort of, although really if you want to go back far enough, you could argue Nixon was the one that opened the Chinese trade door, okay, to a degree, right?
Oh, yeah, ping pong diplomacy.
Yeah, I mean, but Clinton was the one that really expanded it, although, I would argue that the guy should have gone to prison immediately for the Lorillard thing.
Would he have been in the same cell as Reagan when around Contra?
Well, yeah, okay, he can go too. Of course, at least for Reagan, we'd now have to send Bones to jail, right?
Yeah.
So the thing is that when you look at this, once that got put in place, given the dollar's relative stability, not that the dollar has been a good store of value over long periods of time, but
it has been up until like the last 5 years.
Well, relative stability matters, right? And so the thing is that as global trade has expanded, if you are taking your payments in dollars, the expansion of that trade is essentially a sequestration of the inflationary impulse that comes from federal deficits. And so if I'm running, if global trade goes up by $300 billion across the entire planet, and the U.S. dollar is the majority currency that all that's handled in, maybe we get 250 of it, then $250 billion of deficit spending in the United States has no inflation consequence because it's being sequestered from goods and services that are in transit. It's not that it stays sequestered. It obviously doesn't when they get delivered. But it's the delta. It's not the flow. It's the change. And that has been true for a long time. And as soon as the Ukrainian-Russian thing got going and we started sanctioning uninvolved parties, that got blown up. And it's never coming back. So now, as soon as that happened, that inflationary impulse from federal deficit spending instantaneously reflects back into the U.S. economy, and it's not going to go away.
Well, you could, if the Fed, the interesting part of, my criticism of Jerome Powell, and I don't think anybody could do it. I don't think it'd be Solomon and Morgenthau or anybody. The Fed is supposed to be independent, and the idea is they're not supposed to let if Congress decides they're going to spend a lot more money than they take in,
right?
The Fed should just say, borrow it. we're not printing it for you. But nobody does that. I mean, right. they're very political. And the weird part of it is I would, my concern with Powell is he's not doing the job that I think he should do, is resisting all these people. and Trump's all over for resisting him too much, which is kind of so bizarre that hey, have you talk about page two, because we only have you for a half hour. What do you know about this Kathleen Webb? I've listened to her about on four interviews now, and I'm pretty impressed. The lady's wrote a 1,000-page book and two books each, 1,000 pages on Epstein.
The thing about all of this is that people have the memories of flies, all right? That there was hinky, weird stuff going on with that guy was something that I was aware of in the 1990s. Now, exactly how hinky wasn't known until all of a sudden, in the mid 2000s, he gets busted in Florida, right? But there were just too many things going on. I mean, and the Hinkie stuff, from my point of view, was simply financial. None of what went on. I mean, do you remember that he was part of a company? I think it was Tower Financial that blew up. I think it was Tower.
Well, he was known as a expert money launderer.
Yeah, but I mean, but the guys that were running that organization, they got arrested, okay. But he skated, and yet there were rumors that he was really the guy that was behind it, right? That was doing the Hinkie stuff. But he resigned and left. Gee, how propitious, right?
Yeah,
isn't it funny how that happens? And so, there was all kinds of stuff like that. It's like, okay, what the H is really going on here? Because it's kind of like, during the this time around with Trump, right? Isn't it just amazing how this company's stock goes up by 10 points or 15 points 4 days before this deal is announced,
yeah.
Right? That directly benefits them. And when Biden was in office, same thing. With the solar.
There was nowhere. Well,
yeah, it was the same. It was the same crap.
That's the one. You and I have a fundamental difference in the way we think in some regards. I mean, I don't think it's too horrible, but there are people, friends of mine from Notre Dame, who, when you get this image and likeness and you're giving people millions of dollars and half of them aren't even going to school and they're transferring every year. Well, when I was in school, Notre Dame got written up, spanked a little bit about, but the stuff was one of the assistant coaches giving a guy a Greyhound ticket to go home for his uncle's funeral, that kind of crap.
Yeah.
And people say, it was always happening. Come on. Come on. It's such a different degree that it's not even the same. It's like getting Uncle Charlie a job and working the precinct on the poll day. It's a little, I guess it's a little bit of graft. It's not the same as getting $50 million over because you rigged a bid on an expressway. I mean, we're not talking about the same planet and some of this stuff.
But that's the point, is that, like the stuff that's happened with NIL, it is, that we now have third parties that are doing this stuff, is where I draw the line and say, okay, now we're outside the realm of, of what was intended. And then, the problem is, of course, whatever you started with, someone turns around and sues.
Oh, yeah.
All right. And so, as soon as that kind of crap starts, and you know what? If sports at the college level are going to be a professional game, okay, but then I have another problem with that, which is universities are supposed to be about education. Explain to me how professional sports teams...
Well, in the words of Rick Tallender 30 years ago, he says you're going to end up with 40 University of Alabama sponsored, whether they'll be LLCs or whatever they are, sports teams that have really nothing to do with Alabama other than the name. And you might actually have a club team at Alabama that goes plays like they used to. But hey, get back on the, I mean, I'm driving you toward this lady and I probably shouldn't be, but I've listened to probably five of her things now. And some of this stuff, I mean, if you listen, I'm starting to listen more. I'm starting to get like you. I listen to all this. And the guy says, well, what are you writing a book for 1,000 pages for? It was actually a lady interview, and she goes, well, here's the problem, and it sounds like us on the show, honestly. She goes, I bump along and I run into some bank where the money's being laundered by.
Right.
And all of a sudden, I recognize it. I've heard that name before. So I end up, I essentially have to branch out a chapter and research this bank. And she is taking this all the way, and it's, everybody almost laughs and just disgusted by, the guy's hot tub with the women's breasts in there so he could play with them while he was in the hot tub. I mean, I'm like, Carl, what do you get a vendor for that?
good question. I mean, we make jokes about stuff like that. I probably still have it. I don't know. It may have fallen apart. When I used to hang out on my boat, I had a beer koozie that was in the front of it was in the shape of a pair of women's tits.
So, you know, you put your beer in it, right? And it, you know, there.
I remember those things, yeah. Well, she
was giving to me, it was a joke.
But one of the things she's been, this last interview I listened to her, and boy, it hit home. Because this, we've been talking on the show about the Epstein thing and other stuff. And we always say that it's on five different levels. What level do you want to talk about? And she says, you know, as I go back and research these people, and a lot of it started with, what's her name, Maxwell's father.
Right.
And I guess he might have been abusive or whatever. It doesn't make her a victim. Well, maybe it did for a while. But I guess the brother who was supposed to be the heir, didn't he get wiped out in a car crash or something?
There was all kinds of weird
But this guy has all these, he's from, did he survive the Holocaust or something like that? And so he knew, and he's Jewish, but evidently knows all these people in Israeli intelligence. Evidently there's a big connection with the people in the Balkans, the Russians, the CIA. And her point is, all these organizations in World War II sort of got together with the CIA and MI6 and people for reasons of war production and things like that. And they just have never really split apart. They're still the same. And she goes, if you look at these banks, the reason why I mentioned the Iran-Contra, if you look at these banks and you look at these people and you trace it all the way back, they're the same people that did Iran-Contra that are behind this guy. And she goes, if you're really going to get involved in this, and I think most people left and right are on level three. And I'll say level three, where they want, if there's a captain administrator, if there's a politician that went down there to buff 14-year-olds, you know, we want them outed. And by the way, I have no problem with that, by the way. We want them outed. I find it so disgusting. But she says these people are being set up to be influenced by somebody.
Right.
She goes, we need to find out who the somebody is. That's way more important, really, than on some level of these guys being enticed to, well, I don't know if they had to be enticed, mess around with young girls and for people to have something on them. We want to know who the people are that have the something on these people. And she goes, we're never going to get there because we're 70 years into it and we're still not doing that. And you know what? I kind of thought of a little bit like that, Carl, but she put it out there pretty damn straight.
That's the thing, is that, you know, my reason for wanting to I want it all on the table, okay? And I'm tired of people saying, oh, you know, let it go,
when you say, I'm interrupting too much, but when you say you want it all on the table, everybody in their own mind is going to say, what's all? And most people are going to say, saying you're all, I know what your all means. Other people don't.
My all means I want all the money flows out of the table.
Okay. Every time I try and agree with you, I have trouble. When you say all, I know exactly what you mean.
Yep.
But if you say all in tonight's bar, they're going to think you want the names of the guys that were messing around with the 14-year-olds. You want that, but that's not where you want to stop.
Well, that's where I'd like to start.
Yeah, but I'm saying they think that's the issue. It's a bunch of Arabs and rich people. They think it's a bunch of Arabs and rich people paying or to go down there, and it's a lot of money, and where's the money? And that's where I'm, you know, you shouldn't be bitching about people. That's where most people, that's the top of their level here. You and I want to know, why would you do this in the first place? You do it to get stuff on people. And I want to know who those people are.
It's like the whole thing with Hastert, right?
Yeah.
Okay. How many, that he was playing this game or that game with, you know, with some kid. Okay, whatever. Yeah, that's bad. Yeah, he should have been busted and thrown in jail for it. However, I'm a whole lot more interested in who used it to extract what. And what laws got passed or killed and weren't legitimately passed.
I will I'll do you a favor. I will ask Wayne, years ago, Wayne was on the show, and then he wasn't for a while, but now he is. Years ago, one of the most amazing stories Wayne ever told was about Denny Hastert. And he goes, the guy came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, he's a House Speaker, and he's like, who is this guy? I'm from Illinois. I never knew the name.
Well, you know what? I lived in Illinois for a good long time.
But right. but he said everybody knew the guy had an issue. And I said,
yeah.
I said, how'd you know that? And he goes, well, we're gonna have to go here to Joel because we had a lot of stuff to talk about on Friday. But he said the everybody gets what two junkets a year. So you know you go to Africa or Europe
right,
or whatever.
Right.
Every year, he and a guy from California always took a junket to Thailand.
Ah!
And he goes, okay, why is everybody... So we knew he had an issue.
So we knew what was good. We knew kind of what was going
on.
Yeah.
And we knew how quickly he got here. We never could figure out who was pulling his string.
Yeah, but somebody was.
Somebody was. But on Thursday, I'll ask if he knows any kind of more. Do we have Joel, Ricky?
He's not here.
He's not just yet, but he's probably going to join in soon.
All right, well, then we'll just keep going, Carl, until... But yeah, because he said everybody knew that after a while, the people... Okay, everybody knew that he had an issue,
yeah.
and that somebody was controlling him.
But nobody yanked the string and unraveled it. Right.
But and you're right. Now the question is, what did they gain for that?
Right. And that's the problem.
Yeah. And you and I, well, as one of the longer contributors in the show, how many times a year do I bring up the boring ass thing about if I give somebody a $1,000, what do I get? If I give $100,000, what do I get? Yeah, what exactly am I buying? I mean, well, maybe we'll have that discussion Friday as well.
Well, there you go.
All right. Why don't you hang around in case Kenny does, but I think he probably will be in. But Joel, you with us, bud?
Yeah, good morning, Chief.
How are you?
I'm doing super. I'm doing super, Chief.
Well, good.
Couldn't be any better on this Tuesday.
Well, you know, when you got a team that goes like 1-12 and they're still six games up, you're doing pretty good.
Yeah. Baseball, you know, like my dad told me, like everyone knows, baseball is a game of streaks, and they've had some hot streaks, got the big lead. Pitching kind of left us temporarily. I mean, Chief, you know about sports.
Yep.
You're an athlete, right? It's all about timing. It's all about tapering. It's all about that perfect, getting that best form at the best time. So... still maintaining that lead. Now they're back on a two-game winning streak. So we're talking sports. I like that, Chief.
Well, I was mentioning to Carl, there's no joy in Mudville in Chicago after last night.
What happened last night?
Ryan Sandberg died.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Rhino, 65 years old. Boy, been a bad streak, huh? I mean, Ozzy Osbourne, Hulk Hogan, and all, you know. As they say in the Jewish religion, death comes in threes. So hopefully that's it.
But he had the one of my favorites actually was Chuck Mangione too this week, last week.
Oh, he really?
Yeah.
Man, oh man. Okay.
I saw him at least once, maybe twice in Milwaukee Summerfest. God, was he good? God, was he good?
Yeah.
Was a flugelhorn he played, right?
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, I think it's called a flugelhorn, and Greg Pappas used to help us out with the show, and he's going to start calling in, I think, on Mondays and give us the crush report and all that stuff going on in the Board of Trade, because his job now, he's trading the crack spread.
Pappas Financial?
No, this is Greg Pappas, the guy who was helped us out with the producing for a while.
Oh, no, I don't remember him.
Well, I'll tell him that he's already been forgotten. He was on Monday and Thursday, so he wouldn't have.
Yeah, how's Batty Ice doing?
Fine. He's chasing the two daughters around.
And what about that young lady? She's a singer.
She
had a car accident.
You know what? She never went back to her job at Lakeside Bank either. I mean, you're talking about what was her name? She was a singer in she was from Brazil. Singer, and she walked out to do an encore, and somebody had moved the stage, and she fell off and wrecked her ankle.
Yeah.
Eliana.
Yeah, wow.
Nice lady. Fiery lady, boy, I'll tell you. But she ran a band. I mean, they would go drive her on weekends up, you know, Wisconsin, Michigan, and do stuff. And she was a go-getter. And, but she couldn't, she was immobile for a while. And I think she had to move back home, her mom and so forth. And, it was not a fun thing, but I think she's back pretty much 100%. I hope so. But yeah, I haven't heard from Angelica in a while. Angelica's, I know, last I heard, her mom was going studying English and had two jobs. She got her mom out of Ukraine, thank God. She, you know, it's whenever people say, it might have been, Ukraine's fault, come on. Show me a picture of the hospital she was born in and the school she went to, and they're just rubble on the ground. It's a...
Not pretty, Chief. No, not pretty.
So what do you think of our well, I guess it's a sideshow, but our president having a hissy fit with the Fed chairman, and yet I got this money supply growth touching 7.5% now. What are we doing? I mean, everybody thinks that they're geniuses because the market keeps going up. Well, of course it's going up. We're pouring money into the system. I mean, when's the fire escape on this? 10%, 20%? I mean, how far are we going to go?
I don't know, Chief. It seems like such a distant future for that. Unbelievable trend. The trend is your friend. Goldilocks market. They're even liking the earnings today, except for Whirlpool. Boy, that Battle Creek company. Battle Creek Michigan just getting flushed down the toilet. Shark Ninja. Does everyone have a Shark Ninja? Look at the chart. Look at the divergence between Shark Ninja, SN, and Whirlpool. So Whirlpool, what does that say about the consumer? Are they not buying those big ticket items, or what?
Well, I tell you, I've got some. As you well know, we get a lot of accounts that, be perfectly blunt, other people don't want, in the sense that they're concentration issues, and maybe people are hanging on them for tax reason or whatever, and we protect them for a lot of people. I tell you what, Joel, some of these stocks we've got not as much because one person died. We used to have a real lot of UPS, now we still have some. Stock was 208 when we got it; it's 97.
Yeah.
And then you look at Accenture, the big worldwide consulting firm. When we got all that stock, it averaged in the mid threes, and now it's where the hell is it? Now it's 277. I mean, there's all kinds of stocks that you could have that aren't doing very well. I mean, if you're not in these top seven or some around there, you could put Adobe in there. Those things they're more expensive by a factor of 40% than they ever were in 1999, and yet doesn't seem to faze anybody. I mean, every day we continue. I mean, Nvidia, another 230 this morning. It's up. What's that? That's $70 billion in market cap before we even opened, for God's sake.
Yeah.
I mean, these numbers are astronomical. They make $3 a share. So you would say that if you buy a stock that's 179, well, you used to say that stock should be earning $16, $17 a share. Or 15, and I should be getting a check for 4 or 5. When does anybody even dream that Nvidia is going to do that for anybody? I mean, they'd have to be the only company left in the world to do that, their size.
They're big. AMD's been playing some catch up with that. I don't know if that's been mentioned at all.
Yeah.
But it's just not Nvidia. Broadcom's making some nice moves. It's hard to group. I'm no chip expert, but you got to wonder when Micron here, good earnings report. It's been really pretty much straight down here, consolidating at the 50-day moving average. So maybe Micron will play some catch up. Chief, if you want something to worry about, you just don't worry about anything in this market. I hear they're delisting puts and only to sell them. But you got, after the close tomorrow, you got Meta, you got Microsoft, you got Robinhood, you got Qualcomm. I mean, and then on Thursday you got Amazon, you got Apple. So Friday you got the jobs number, of course, ExxonMobil, yep, and Chevron. So there are things here that could upset the market.
No matter what it is, no matter how bad they are, guys come out and talk their game. And since the analyst world is not like it used to be, they put out the number and then they beat the number. Well, duh. I mean, of course, they beat expectators. I'll take a line from Richard J. Daley. Who are these expectators? Do you even know any analysts like there used to be?
You see some sell ratings a little bit, here and there, scattered, but they're all in the predictive mode. I mean, no one wants to hear anything negative.
No,
Chief.
No.
They just want to hear the positive. But
that, you know, from my monetary background, that we would never do this again, and we'd never get here again. Yet I'm not so sure that we're not going to. I'm convinced now we're going to push it as far as we possibly can, which could be another 2, 3, 4 years. But I know if these guys keep pushing this like this, we're going to see a 6 or 7 or 8% 30- and 10-year rate, and I don't know how the market pushes through that. I mean, plus, I don't really know how to. You know, as a half-assed monetarist, I don't see how you don't somehow count the wealth bubble with the cryptocurrencies, because it's being used as money and being thought of as money, and it's $2 trillion. I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't add all of it to the money supply, but I also don't think you should add none of it either. What do you think?
Try not to think in this market, Chief.
What's I'm saying? We once in a while we'll sell a call somewhere, and we get even the stocks that are going down every day. We don't want to sell calls in there either for fear there's going to be some big turnaround. And thank God we've had puts in some of the ones that gotten clobbered, but the puts everywhere else. You know, when you mention something, we're not going to have puts anymore. In August of '87, 2 months before the crash, people actually had buttons made up on the floor, say no to puts. Don't let anybody.
Well, we'll see if we get to that point, but we'll see. We'll see. We got some earnings from the big boys. See if that shakes things up, Chief. So,
what should be? Are you? How many Tigers games are you going to?
I've been to one. Probably go to a couple more. I'd like to go to the. Hopefully, they'll make the playoffs. But been a busy summer so far. But made it to one, and they won that one, and. We'll make a few more here in August and then see you in the stretch.
I like that park. It's a nice park.
Comerica Park. Nice place. Okay, Chief, right. As always, go blue. We'll talk to you next
All right,
week.
Take care. Do we have Kenny?
Yes, we do.
Kenny,
we do.
How are you? What's
I'm
up, buddy?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm in a, we're hanging in there. We had a big run up in our – we had a lot of people in the medals, big run up in there, and then we kind of settled back down here a little bit. But we did roll our puts up, so we got a little bit of that back. But I'm markets – I'm surprised the president keeps bitching at Powell, and last month I got the money supply growth at 7.5%. What more does he want the guy to do?
He's going to bitch until he gets what he wants, which I'm not saying is correct, but I'm saying that's what he's going to do, right? He's not going to... Certainly, if Powell doesn't cut rates tomorrow, you can expect to hear a lot more bitching and complaining from him. But, I think at the moment, I think Powell's doing the right thing. Now, I think he's going to hint that the committee is now starting to split, and that, you know, come the fall, there's going to be, you know, we can look forward to rate cuts in the fall. But I think the market already expects that. So I'm not expecting that they're going to say anything so dramatic. I'm going to be shocked if they change the narrative tomorrow morning, because if they were going to do that, we would have it would have been leaked. Nick Timiraos from the Wall Street Journal would have leaked the story, or Goldman Sachs would have put out a special report, because that's how they would have leaked it to the market. And they haven't done that. So I'm going, history suggests that they're not going to change their mind. And look, the market's betting they're not going to change their mind.
Well,
so I think nobody should be surprised when they don't change their mind. I think, you know, what they're all going to be listening to is, okay, what's he saying about September? Is that, you know, when the cut is coming, and how big potentially? Is it going to be 25 or 50? I think that's going to be, you know, what the focus is tomorrow.
Well, how come, well, it's unfair to ask you, because the whole world has moved on from the monetarist world, but how do you let your money supply growth get up to 7.5 and somehow, which is amazingly inflationary, but it's also pouring enough money in the system where I have to believe the short-term rates are lower. The only thing that they're not saying is they're announcing that they're lower. They actually are already lower. He has already cut the rates.
They are lower, but they are lower. But, you know, Trump wants that headline number that everyone's looking at, you know, the 4.25 number. He wants that to be, look, he said he wants them to cut by 300 basis points. That's ridiculous. That you can't go from 4.25 to 1.25 or 1.5 in one move. You just can't. It's not like this country's going into depression. Far from it. right? You walk around and you see the economy is robust and strong and remains that way. The labor market's strong. And so, you know, seeing a small cut is one thing, but seeing this ridiculous 300 basis point cut is another thing, which I certainly don't think is going to happen. But expect to hear Trump scream and yell and stamp his feet if he doesn't get anything, which I don't think he's going to get.
Well, we're talking about a dude, and I think even, you know, people that, wherever you sider you are, whether you like Trump, put up with Trump, can't stand him, whatever it is, right. I think it's very obvious that the man is doing serious business on his own out of the White House.
100%.
And he owns a bunch of property. You know, by the way, he's of German descent, which isn't, you know, the people who made out like a bandit in the Weimar Republic is anybody who owned property. When you inflated the place, which he wants to do, if you drop your interest rates down to 1, he wants to pay less interest, maybe for the people of the U.S., but certainly for him. And oh, by the way, that mortgage on the Doral is going to look a hell of a lot easier to pay off if we
agreed.
Some people do very well in inflationary environments. Some people don't, and he's one of the people that does. But I tell you what, Kenny. On the big numbers, I mean, I hear this stuff on the way in this morning. I'm hearing a report on News Radio 78 that the small farm debt this year is higher than it's ever been, more bankruptcies than there ever have been. I mean, Greg Pappas last 2 years ago, he was, you know, he's still helps out with the show, but he's trading the crack spread at 7 in the morning, so he can only come in a little bit. Said that the farmers 2 years ago made an average of $220,000. Last year was like 65. This year, I don't think it's even that. So there's an undercurrent of all the market going up every day that isn't so hot. When people say when you say the economy is doing great, you got to just say which part. Because some are and some aren't. I mean, they said there are more bankruptcies in small businesses in the last 5 months, and then it's like a record number.
Well, you know, it's funny because I'm not denying that that's not true, but those aren't the headlines that you see. Those are buried right within the pages. You're not seeing that on the front page of Bloomberg, or you're not seeing that on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. And nor, by the way, is any economist and analyst really highlighting that,
well,
right? So it's like anything, right? They tell the story they want to tell, right, because it fits their narrative.
Well, not only that, I mean, the people that command more CNBC than the other stuff, they want you to send them a check and charge you 1 to 1.5%, and they want that market to go up every day. I mean, that's no matter what. I mean, most people there, I mean, you're probably an exception, they say, what do you think you should do? I think you should call me up and take all your money and put it in a bank. You're not going to get that message anywhere from any one of these guys, are you?
I mean, no. I
mean, so it's a question of, you know, what sells. The blur between financial TV and news, I mean, I'll pick on CNBC. I mean, you'll get these interviews, but I think you know better than most, more than me. By the way, I had dinner with your buddy Dr. J last night. Had a nice time.
Oh, really? Where'd you see him?
Well, he was in town. He and his lovely bride went out. Audrey came down, and we went to dinner, and was palled a little bit when the death of Ryan Sandberg came across the stage, because Jan and I used to go watch him all the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, he would tell me that when guys come on, the most important thing is to get access to the chairman first after the earnings, and to have access to the Fed. Because you put those guys on, they tell you what the questions they'll answer. And if you ask them something out of the blue, something like you and I might ask, or me for sure, they're never coming back. I mean, you're never going to see Steve Leisman giving Powell a bad question at the thing. He's not going to be first in line again, right? So it becomes it's to a certain extent it's news. To another extent, it's playing the ratings. I mean, and what are the ratings? I mean, you don't want people on there talking about money supply and how these guys are going over the top and how it's 1972 all over again. You don't want to hear that.
You don't want to hear that at all.
Yeah. Yet it's, you know, people wonder why. How is it that I put $1 million in the bank 5 years ago, and it sure feels like I got a $500,000 left. but it does, right?
Yeah, no, yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. It does. But look, Let's just get back to the market for 1 minute. So yeah. I think, look, we're into August. We're really now in the dog days of summer, and August tends to be kind of a quieter month, which tends to also can be volatile just because it's a quieter month. People away from their desks and that kind of stuff. And we're going into, tomorrow's the FOMC meeting, so we'll get through that. Then there's nothing until September. So you'll have Jackson Hole. You'll get some information maybe out of Jackson Hole. That's what people look at next. But look, August is kind of just this month where you sit and you wait. You don't make big trading decisions unless there's some big move in the market. Other than that, you can expect the market just to kind of churn. I think it's going to churn lower. I think it's still overbought. The S&P is well into overbought territory based on its RSI. So is the NASDAQ. So is the Mag 7. While the other indexes are not, they're still kind of in that normal trading range. If the market starts to back off a little bit, they'll take the whole place down. Certainly, the ones that are overpriced will get hit versus the ones that are not. They'll still get hit, but not nearly as much. And I don't think anyone should be surprised about that, quite honestly. I would think if you're a long-term investor, you want to see the market pull back, 3 or 4%, shake it out a little bit, and give you a chance to put more money to work. Because at the moment, any money that I'm putting to work, it's just sitting in the government money market fund making 4.25% until I see that pullback happen.
When you look at some of the stocks that have run up recently, and it's not one of the seven, but it was one of the five or six in 2000.
Yeah.
What do you make of a stock like Oracle, where on a revenue per share thing is 40% higher than it was in 99?
How do you reconcile that? It's funny. Oracle's not a name that I own, so I don't really pay attention to it. But, how do you reconcile that is that it's a different world, right? Money is different. The environment is different. Technology has created a new world. And so maybe valuations have to change. Clearly, they have to, because to your point, this is trading much higher than it was in 1999.
Well, I mean,
something has changed, right?
Well, I mean, it could every day. I mean, it's kind of, we haven't really had. We've got tariffs back and forth. We got all kinds of crazy stuff going on, but nothing has really tampered with the 401ks every week with the Fed pouring money in. Every day, yeah. No matter what. I mean, the same thing happens off, Kenny. I'm sure you're still getting money from people.
Yeah.
We're buyers every week, damn near.
Yeah.
I mean, the money pile, a check will come in from somebody wants to add to his account. Buy a little more of this, buy a little more of that. And we're in this relentless what could go wrong, and I've had five people in the last 3 weeks say, as long as I'm in the market, I'm making 20% a year, this is just great. And I'm going, there's no thought that Nvidia could be trading 60 or 50.
Right.
There's not even a dream of that.
And
that there are times when that's valuation, $3 earnings and $6 revenue, I'll give you $40 for it. Not 180. I mean, they've got this incredible growth, but all you got to do is put a plug in that a little bit and say they're not going to double the next 5 years in a row and just say they're going to grow by 30%. Where does that stock go? I mean, you talk about price to perfection. Good Lord.
No, I hear you. I hear you. And something, if you, and I said this again in my note this morning, look at where the VIX is. It's deep, deep, deep in the complacent zone, and all we're going to need is one negative headline that people are not expecting, and boom, the bottom's going to fall out. I don't mean fall out down 20%, but I mean you'll see a very swift pullback in the market because everyone's pricing in, everything's great, nothing wrong, nothing could go wrong. That's exactly when you have to be very, very, on target and very awake and expecting that one negative headline, because it's going to come. It's going to come. It's going to be a headline that no one's expecting, and it's going to hit us out of left field, and you'll see the market, the algos will react very quickly, and the market will retrace.
I think you're going
to
find...
I think that's what people need to be worried about at the moment.
I think what could upset the apple cart dramatically is either the people at the Bureau of Labor Statistics wake up and actually do something with the CPI, and which means, you're going to get a 1.5% number 1 month, which will take your 30-year rates to 6.5-7. That's the danger. That's the thing where people are going to go, what the bleep? I mean, there was a guy, I don't know if I sent it to you. I didn't, but a guy who had, he's from 2000 to this year regarding insurance what companies pay for insurance for their health insurance.
Yeah.
And I think the big hole in the CPI, as Carl always talks about, is we've talked about, I should have it up here with these numbers, where we should have, in 2000, it was $6,000 a year for health insurance for somebody. Now it's up to something like, it's up 2.5%. It's like $2,000 a month. So it's up to like 20. The individual employee's contribution to it is higher than the whole number was in 2000. And if you talk about somebody who's making $75,000, and the number is 25, well, how in the hell, you and I can do the math, we don't need a calculator, how is that 6% of my basket? So, I mean, so you're really saying I would be making $100,000, not 75, if the firm wasn't paid for my self-insurance, and they're paying for it because it's deductible to them and not to me, which is even more absurd. Well, 25 grand of 100,000 is not 6%. I think you and I don't need a calculator to know that.
No, right.
So maybe it'll just be a realization that those, you know, an article by somebody like you, somebody people believe, all of a sudden, hey, I just did a back of the envelope scratch on this CPI in the last 15 years, and these guys are off by like 20%. Someday that message is going to hit, and it's going to hit like a fart in church. And you know, will it drive, you know, one day we're going to have the 30-year rate not go up to 5 and come flying right back down. It might go right through. That's the danger. I'm not predicting it. I'm saying you asked where I thought it might come from. That's maybe what it would be. I don't think it's going to be an earnings thing because these guys talk the way around every earnings thing.
They talked the way around on earnings. Yes, yeah. They did. And did you see today's earnings? UNH and Merck, they both, UNH missed, right? So that was down. I don't know if it's still down. I think it is. Merck missed.
It's only down $4.
Oh, because it was down more. It was down nearly $10.
Yeah,
it's rallied back a little bit, right? But I don't think, I think the focus is going to be today and tomorrow squarely on what the Fed, the speculation of the Fed, and what it's going to mean. I don't think that you're going to get a lot of action one way or the other in these earnings reports. In fact, what we've seen is, you know, while we've had 78 or 80% of the companies beat, you haven't seen these stocks, you know, surge. The stocks that have beat, they haven't. They've actually kind of churned and traded lower with guys, people taking money off the table.
Well, we played a earnings play in IBM. You know, we do these little time spreads. It's a relationship between the calendar spread and the straddle.
Yep.
And it's the same position really, so they should have in my opinion, a lot of times they don't, Kenny. There should be a relationship between how big the straddle is and the price of the time spread.
Right.
And a lot of most of the times there isn't. Sometimes there isn't. And IBM is one of those that are like that. I mean, the straddle I think was like $15, and we put the time spread on for 40 cents, you know, which...
Yeah.
Well, guess what? It's down, and it was trading 325, I think, and we did the... Now what do we do? No, we was trading... We did a strike 5 hours under because we were a little bearish. The thing's down $30.
From what
it was over 300, wasn't it?
It was over 300, I think, yeah.
Yeah, now it's 263.
It's
gotten buried. I mean, the straddle was a third of the move.
Right.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's nuts. No, it's nuts.
And, but now, is UPS going out of business? Well, now it's only down three. The thing's 98.60. It was 3 years ago, it was 208 because we were managing it for somebody who unfortunately passed. But we had a whole bunch of stock in there. It was trading, when we got it, it was 208. Now it's 98.
No, I don't think it's going out of business, but I do think the world is changing, right? And certainly there's been pressure on UPS for sure.
Yep.
But they got to get their act together, right? Whether it's cost, whether it's streamlining, they've got to get it together. And I think they keep saying that, right? Every time they report, they're starting to implement savings plans, and they're cutting the jobs, and they're doing all that stuff. They've got to get it together in order for that stock to rebound.
Well, they're competing against somebody who can do vertical pricing on their stuff.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, because it's not really arm's length what Amazon's doing with their own stuff. But
no, they're also competing against Amazon that's now delivering stuff by drone, right?
Yeah.
I call up and I order something on Amazon, and 3 hours later, it's sitting on my doorstep.
Do you have those, I've seen a few of them. I mean, I don't order stuff out like that, but the little cart that runs along the sidewalk on its own.
Yeah, no, I don't. I don't have that. It's not where I live. I have not seen. I've only seen it in, you know, in ads or commercials or, you know, that they're showing it. I have not actually seen it.
I've seen a thing buzzing along the sidewalk, and I go, that thing looks weird.
Yeah.
I mean, anyway. Yeah. Well, are you still at the Cod, up in the Cape Cod?
Yeah, I'm still at the Cod. Actually, tomorrow's my last day. I'm leaving here tomorrow. I've been here for a month. And this is where I grew up. So for me, it was coming home, right?
Yep.
But I'm here just until tomorrow, and then I'll be back in Florida on Saturday. I'm going to New York for a couple of days, and then I'm going back to Florida.
How brutal is the weather in Florida?
Actually, you know something? The weather in Florida is not so, according to the people I'm talking to, it's typically hot, but it's not necessarily any hotter than it usually is. So, you know. And look, again, I'm still working, so I get up every morning and I go from my car to my office and back. It's not like I'm sitting outside on the beach. I'm not doing that, and I'm not sitting outside playing golf all day.
We're gonna send a drone down to check this out.
Yeah,
see something flying over. It's us. Everybody, fly safe. Good talking to you as usual. SP Futures up 16. NASDAQ Futures up 115. Should we go right to Professor Hell? We'll do our break 7:30. What do you want to do, Ricky?
I actually just saw Hell in the meeting, but he kind of just left. Let's go on a quick break.
All right, we'll go for a quick break. Be right back. Action Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Low and up back, Stocks and Jocks. Now come on, Ricky on the board. SP Futures up 16, NASDAQ Futures up 115. And we have Professor here. I can hear him in the background.
Hey, what's up, Tom?
How are you, bud?
Doing pretty good. Just building out my history of economic thought course. It's taking a lot of work. I told you last week I was using a modeling approach to it. So,
AI?
We start with Babylon and its price controls. Okay. And then we use modern tools like linear demand and supply to analyze the effects of those price controls and why there was crime and why the king of Babylon had to criminalize behaviors that are the result of the consequences of price controls, whether they're, you know, you're in a famine or you're in the good times. When you're in the good times, the king's price is going to be greater than the market price. So there's, you know, consequences that come out of that. And then when you're in a famine, supply collapses because, you know, the agricultural economy is very dependent on weather. So the supply collapses and the price ends up being greater than the king's set price. And in famine, you want there to be stores of grain and barley to flow out of the warehouses to feed the people. But during, you know, the good times when the weather is great and ideal for growing barley and wheat, you want the taxes, you want the surpluses from the crops. You want to cull that and put it in the storage. But it's pretty fascinating. And then I got Lafreker from the Mukdima, a 12th or 13th century Islamic scholar, came up with Lafreker well before.
How could you come up with a Lafreker before Laffer?
it's old. It's 14th century. It's back when the...
Are you saying that if Laffer would have gotten the patent on that, it would have been a crooked patent?
Yeah, well, I don't think he could have got a patent on it because he's always said that he didn't. It wasn't his idea. He got it from reading. I think he said he got it reading. Got it from reading.
A lot of people that have gotten patents know it wasn't their idea.
Yeah, I know, yeah. Well, you know, the patent office lawyers used to ask you, is it your idea? And I remember telling one, because I was gonna patent my dad's potato rock separator. It separated rocks from potatoes. And I had drawn up the plans, and him and I discussed it. And I met with a patent lawyer. And she asked me a question: did I invent it? I go, no, it's my dad's idea. And she goes, well, you can't patent it then. So, I kind of like.
The guy down the street will run in there. The guy down the street will get on a pad as long as he's there first.
Yeah, maybe, I know. Now maybe, I think the law's changed. You can actually patent it now.
What makes you think her brother-in-law didn't patent it?
I'm not really the only one that knew about it.
Oh, all right.
My dad was homeless for years after the divorce, after two bankruptcies. He kind of was an alcoholic, and he ended up in a mental institution. And then after he something happened to him where he changed. He was a really violent drunk. But after things happened and there was no moral hazard in his life. He paid, you know, the full cost of abandoning kids and bankruptcies, you know, with humiliation. So in his 40s and 50s, you wouldn't have met a nicer, kinder person in your life. Just nice, sweetest person you ever meet in your life. And all he had was a suitcase of clothes and a crappy car and a $1,200 trailer that he had parked on a farm in Idaho. But he was, in my opinion, he was like a crazy genius. He came up with this idea, and he built it. He built this thing that separated rocks from potatoes. The owner of the fresh pack,
in the ground, or once you pull them out?
Oh no! This was actually when you put it in the warehouse. When you put the potatoes in the warehouse, normally you have humans pull on the rocks out of the potatoes.
Well, how do you get the rocks in with the potatoes in the first place?
Come out of the ground that way.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, they come out of the. You dig them up, right? Because a digger.
Well, you dig them up. You can't just pull a potato out. You got to dig
it. A big rock will go over the top of the digger, but rocks the size of potatoes will come out of the ground with the potatoes.
All right.
And you have to put people on the diggers to separate the rock, but rock gets through. So he came up with this interesting idea, this genius idea. And he was telling me one night, we were in this really crappy one-bedroom apartment that he lived in on a farm in rural north central or northeastern Idaho over by Du Bois. He was telling me about it one night. I go, Dad, that is a freaking genius idea. Why didn't you do anything with that? Because he was always one that was always looking for a quick buck, right? And that's why I think a lot of his farms failed. He was really interesting. He didn't want to grow alfalfa, right? You had to follow alfalfa after a few years of potato growing because you had to put nitrogen back in the soil. And so what he'd do, he'd move us around from farm to farm, and he'd scout out fields that had alfalfa in them that were good potato ground. And he would lease the ground from the farmer that owned the field.
Alfalfa is hay, right?
Yeah, and then he would plant potatoes there, and he would do that, right, because he wanted to avoid growing alfalfa. He thought it was a waste, right? He wanted to just grow potatoes. So he was this really odd person, which is why I'm probably so odd. But he came up with this fascinating idea.
If you like somebody, they're eccentric. If you don't, they're nuts.
Yeah, and the funny thing about my dad is we'd go visit my brothers from Idle Falls, Idaho. You know, I was in graduate school in mathematics, and we'd go visit my brothers and their family, and we'd stop at all the truck stops between Idle Falls and Hermiston, where my half-brother lived, or my brothers, Rod and Ryan, who lived in Lewiston. And he knew everybody in the freaking truck stop. I mean, he could have ran for office, I think. I mean, everybody knew who my dad was. They'd stop by and ask him how he was doing. He's just the nicest, sweetest person you ever meet in your life. And he invented this thing that separated the rock from the potatoes. And I had drew it up that night. I was really good at mechanical drawing. I drew it up that night, and I go, Dad, we could put in, a hydraulic piston to make it auto-adjusting. We wouldn't have to manually adjust.
Why did you foolishly answer the question that it wasn't your idea?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just honest. I wanted to give my dad the props.
Well, but I mean,
it's my dad's idea.
You could say that the Snar Inc. It's our idea.
Yeah, I know I should have, but I just felt like I wanted everybody to know that was my dad's idea. The only person that ever saw it work who probably didn't understand how it worked was the guy that owned this fresh pack where, you know, you put freshly dug up potatoes in boxes in Arizona. My dad built it in Arizona. I go, Dad, did anybody know about that thing? He goes, no. It was just kind of like part of the equipment. And the owner, I go, did the owner really understand what was going on?
Well, when Jay's Potato Chips was here in Chicago, you'd go by and they had the truck platform, the big semis on it, or the trailer, not the tractor trailer unit, the trailer piece of it. was on this thing, and they would raise it up and just dump the entire 45-footer into the plant. Well, I have to believe that they would have liked the rocks to have been removed before the potatoes landed in there.
Yeah, because rocks, when they're transported with potatoes, they bruise them, and it ruins them.
Well, there you go.
And so my idea was not to put it in the fresh pack. My idea was to put it on the digger itself.
All right, so what do you make of...
I never did anything with it. I should have done something with it.
What do you think about our accelerating money supply? Corresponding to our accelerating market.
Yeah, you know, I was listening to a podcast. I walk an hour and a half every night, and I walk an hour and a half every morning. It's probably about six miles a day.
Good for you.
I walk pretty fast. Maybe it's eight miles a day. But I was listening to this podcast with Richard Warner. He was a German economist that was getting his PhD at the London School of Economics. And he was in Tokyo back in like the early 1990s when you had the huge, massive outflows. And at the same time, you had this massive housing bubble. I guess the land in downtown Tokyo was more valuable. A park. There was a park in downtown Tokyo, in central Tokyo, that was more expensive than like half the land of California. It was really an incredible bubble. And at the time, I don't know if you remember this, but at the time, banks were not at all in these macroeconomic models, right? Banks in economics were considered these intermediaries that, you know, took 3 or 4% off.
They were considered to be banks.
Yeah, they were just considered banks, and they were,
which is what they should be today, but they're not.
Yeah, yeah, they scraped off like 3.5%, right? The interest, the net interest margin on savings accounts.
Same thing with your savings and loan. Yeah. Mortgages were 6.25%. They paid 3.25%. I won't say they skimmed. It was 3%.
Yeah.
By the way, their efficiency is probably better than today.
Yeah.
Because the Little League uniforms, the building. Hey, you know, speaking of a story, I forget this in my maturity. Ricky, look up who bought Northwest Airlines. Because whoever bought them ended up with a square block in Tokyo, right when you're talking about, Al.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The real estate was worth more than
Delta
the airline.
Airlines in 2010?
Delta 2010, yeah. That sounds,
yeah, the real estate was... Northwest
was sold before 2010, I thought.
I see that the merger was announced in 2008, maybe?
Yeah, that's 17 years ago. It's about, you know who else was... Capital Cities Broadcasting. I don't know what they actually did, Al, but they bought ABC. And everybody says, well...
Yeah, the Japanese are buying up everything. Remember that time?
Well, Capital Cities bought up ABC, and ABC had a fully depreciated square block building in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And that's why they bought it, was for the building. You know,
I think people were trying to figure out, you know, they sold it what they thought was a peak in Tokyo, and they wanted to put their money somewhere, right? So they were going out and buying up all this property in the United States and in other countries.
The thing was, with land, they're never making any more of it, and they thought that the land, take Pebble Beach. One of my buddies was real close to the Chicago real estate market, claims they bought a... I'm going to say double-digit buildings here. When I say they, I'm talking about the Japanese. They bought Pebble Beach. What'd they lose on Pebble Beach? Like half of what they paid for it? And they lost money in every one of the buildings here, too. But now, you know, stuff is... Well, not, downtown Chicago is not very good, but Pebble Beach now is worth a whole lot because they got houses and stuff out there. But they thought everything was going to be worth what it was in Tokyo. And there were people who thought everything was going to here was going to be worth what it was in Manhattan. And it just sort of never happened. But
I think the current China story, especially during the mid 2010s, and was basically the Japanese story all over again for the most part. You have a central bank trying to keep up with the inflation in the United States, right? They're pegging their currency to ours, so if we're inflating, they're inflating.
But there's no question the China story is a lot like
the Japanese.
What do you make of a 7.5%? Pace last month, but hey, Kenny asked me what I thought maybe could be, you know, It looks to me like the politicians, and certainly with Trump in charge, are going to push this to the envelope. I mean, the guy's a real estate guy. He wants real estate down. He wants interest rates down. He wants inflation up so he can pay off these properties. Okay, I mean, that's what all real estate people do because it's best for them, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. They want the inflation, yeah. Right?
So Kenny asked me what I thought would be the... Where's the fly in the ointment here?
And by the way, it doesn't have to be nefarious. It's just their world, right?
Just their world.
They're looking at their world, and they know that when interest rates are low and inflation
is substantial,
their properties go up in value and their wealth grows.
You and I might be relative dummies, but if we buy the Doral, and the room rates are $200, you inflate the bejesus out of the place, and 10 years from now they're $500. I'm going to say.
Yeah.
The mortgage is a little light, and we're probably already paid it off.
Yeah,
just saying. I mean, that's what happened in Weimar. But I guess where I'm going with this is what is the fly in the ointment? For a while, Russell.
You know, the interesting thing is going back to the Richard Warner story. Because if you look at what the Fed's doing, it's really not adding to reserves. It's not like printing money to buy reserves. It's not printing reserves or printing money to buy treasuries directly or indirectly from the treasury. It's not really doing that. I think they're letting the bonds that they currently own mature. So what they're really doing is just letting that stuff roll off. And Richard Warner said when he noticed that you had these huge massive outflows from Japan, and you had this incredible we can't even imagine the land price inflation in Japan. He actually got into a bank. His research was he was going to go into a bank, and he talked to all the people that in the banking industry, and he wanted to know, economists kind of like theorize how things work, but he wanted to know how banking is actually done, how loans are made and where the funds come from. And he dismissed he found evidence against that banks are just intermediaries, and that it's the multiplier effect from fractional reserve banking. What he actually discovered in Japan is that individual banks make most of the money. They poof, invent it out of thin air. When they make a loan...
They don't invent it out of thin air.
It's not accounting. It's just they make the loan. They don't make it out of reserves. They don't move money from a checking account or a savings account into a loan. They just poof, make the loan.
Well, that's
and it's called credit creation theory, and I think that's what's going on in the United States.
It's not credit creation theory. That's the way it's worked for a gazillion years. I mean, here.
Yeah. But the economic models at the time couldn't explain it, and because banking again was not included in these economic models because banks
when Milton Friedman went back and wrote Monetary History of the United States, it was such an incredible work.
Yeah,
because I mean, what Hal's talking about here, and I'll try and explain Hal and grade my paper. If let's go back to Bonanza time, the Virginia City Bank. If Ben Cartwright drops $100,000 in there because he sold timber from somebody, he's got a check, and Hal goes in and wants to borrow some money. If he borrows, the bank can now lend. Back when reserves were 20%, now they're like zero. But let's say the reserve requirement was 20. The bank can now lend Hal $80,000, right? So now if Hal turns around and puts the 80 right back, he's not going to spend it all today. He puts it right back in a checking account now. The amount of money available in the bank is now $180,000, right?
So Tom, the thing is, the money doesn't have to be redeposited. The guy can spend the money on the car.
Well, it could be in circuit. I'm saying, but the easiest way to explain it is if you put it back in. Yeah. And now can lend the next guy 64.
But let's say he spent it on a car. Right. Well, the car dealership is going to put that money in their checking account.
Right.
So it's going to eventually end up in a checking account.
Well, but the car dealer could also repay a loan, which drops the number.
Yeah.
So I mean, but the point being is when our system allows the system to grow money or to deflate money on its own. So the Fed's job, and you might ask yourself, how is it that the money supply is starting to grow faster and faster, even though the Fed's balance sheet's going down? So what has to happen in good times, if the Fed says we're going to have, like Hal would like them to do, I'll speak for you, he wants them to just have 2% money supply growth and that's it, or 2.5%, and that's your job, man. Well, there are times in good times, the Fed has to act as a brake on that to keep it at 2.5, correct? And then in good times, they actually have, or bad times, they got to actually add money to maintain 2.5. So it's not, if they, when you say they should just do that, that's not an easy job. It's like saying you should just have kids and raise good kids. Well, God bless. That's the hardest job on earth, right? It's not like it's easy, but at least you know what you're supposed to do. That's why these guys, you look at the balance sheet and you go, wow, money supply is seeming like it's growing out of hand here and all of a sudden, and yet the balance sheet's going down. Well, it means they're not running.
I think a lot of it, I think what he discovered was a symptom, and I think the real cancer is the moral hazard that a central bank creates. Moral hazard is something that is learned.
How it feels
from
so good.
Not having to pay the full cost.
It feels so
of
good.
Your bad decision.
Do you think the people watching their stocks go up every day, they think they're genius investors? You think they want the Fed to change policy? Do you think government?
Oh no, they're like realtors and a president who's a builder.
It's
right?
Like
they
it's like
the
shutting
Fed
the bar off. Shutting the bar door and bar off an hour before closing. Nobody wants that.
The city planners want. People run cities like New York City. They want the Fed to continue to inflate.
Well, sure.
Because they can raise taxes by property values going up.
Milton Friedman, once a week, he'd say, that's the problem. It feels so good, you can't let it get started. But, hey, you mentioned the Chinese group when a couple of years ago, and you were on and Russell's on, and Russell had the Chinese, and I'll quiz him about this tomorrow, had the Chinese real estate blow up, for lack of a better term, as one of the potential bombs that rocked, you know, put a stop to the world economy growth, at least for a while. Is that off the table? Because it hasn't happened, or if it has, it's happened so gradually that we've somehow grown over it or something.
Well, I think what the Chinese are doing is they're feeding. They're not doing what the Fed did in 2008-09. I think what they're doing is they're kind of feeding their beast to keep it inflating. And I think that's what the Japanese did for.
Well, they're doing it now more than they ever have.
20 years, right?
They're doing it now more than they ever have.
Yeah, they don't want that house of cards to come.
But nobody wants. I mean, if you ran for office tomorrow and said, "Man, this is not sustainable. We're going to stop this." But by the way, you might get a 20% correction in the stock market, especially this guy who grades himself by it. I can't imagine that happening. So we're going to go until there's a crisis, which might be a decade. It might be 2 decades. It might be next week.
I think the longer it goes, the nastier.
I don't think you're getting any argument there, but why would, I mean,
when it pops, it's going to be really painful.
I mean, let's shift our fannies from where we're sitting to CNBC with some attractive lady across from us said, if you two idiots are right, why hasn't it happened yet? You've been saying this for 10 years. You know, I mean, it's extended itself way more than I ever thought it would. I think a lot of that, Hal, has to do with the coordination of all the different countries doing the same thing.
Yeah, you look at the United States housing prices. You know, the home price index is what, almost twice what it was right before the housing housing price bubble burst back in 2007 and 2008.
Audrey says
it's twice as high.
They're up 16% in the own area.
And I think the Fed is very cautious on not letting that thing pop because of all the pain it caused.
Well,
so we're kind of in a mini situation of the Chinese. Right?
I did a little study in 2007. Well, I keep saying that, but I didn't do it. I was smart enough to read an article from somebody who did do the study. And I can't find it anywhere, Hal, and I wish I could because it was so articulate. The dude.
That's why you need to tweet stuff on. You need to tweet it so that way you can search your Twitter for it.
Tweet in
2000. I use Twitter as my interesting article archive.
Well, you see, I there was no tweet in 2007, as you recall.
Oh, 2007. All right.
And, anyway, the dude wrote an article talking about matching people to housing prices, and I say this a lot, but it's a serious article. I think the housing prices were 235. 240, the median housing price. And he said, if somebody, you either saved it or somebody, your old man, handed you to 45 grand for the down payment, the 20% down, so your mortgage is, you know, 190, say, you needed 85 grand a year to pay for that and, you know, the insurance and taxes.
Yep.
And, yeah. No, granted, if two people could be working, which muddies the water a little bit, but an individual person, you need $85,000 or a couple. And he said, okay, and he went through all the people in Chicago that were making, this is 15% of the population makes $85,000 a year. He went through a regular, whatever you want to call it, a regular cubicle schmo at the time. You know, you take the L downtown and you work in some cubicle doing whatever it is you do, cataloging or something. The average rate there was 40-45. If you were in the restaurant industry, you're lucky to be making 18. This is 2007. Yeah. And he said, and if you're a fairly high up in a hospital, not a doctor but not an executive, you're somebody who works in the chemistry, you know, does blood work or that kind of stuff, you're making 60-65. So basically, he said, you take all the people in all those industries, that's a serious amount of people. So he said 15% of the people can afford the median home, because this is not sustainable. And sure enough, it wasn't. You know, I don't know, all the other crap happened in 2008, whatever, but the fact is, the numbers were there ready for a problem. If you go through those same numbers today, the median home is now, what, 420 instead of 235?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to say, which probably means, the math in my head means you need $150 a year, $150,000 a year to handle that place. What percentage of the population makes $150,000 a year? I'll bet less than 15%. I mean, one person. I mean, I'm talking about families, because the median individual income is what, 40?
Yeah,
42. So, and by any stretch, the numbers are way worse now.
Oh, yeah.
Than they were in 2007, 2008, and everybody thinks there's no problem. And what did Nancy say yesterday? I asked her, Nancy, in the last 100 mortgages that you've done, what percentage of the mortgages that are one of the two in the working family, one of the two, husband or wife, gets laid off, they can afford the mortgage? And she said, zero.
Yeah.
I bet she's wrong. I bet there's like three or four. You know, somebody's got to raise along the way that she hasn't kept track of. But the numbers are perilous, and yet more money comes in. Mark goes up every day. Everybody's happy. So it's, yeah. I'm not looking for there's a problem here. But you sit there and go, what could cause an issue, right? And once you think about it, we'll go to break. We'll have a real break this time. SP Futures up 13. Nasdaq Futures up 105. You're right back. Stocks and Jocks. Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. As you all know, the broad markets, especially tech, have been hot for a while. Lots of reasons. New technology, small fixed income returns, a lot of Fed cash, maybe some good management. Recently, however, the rates on fixed income investments, even U.S. Treasury, have risen from the very low levels. Treasuries are more attractive. There might even be some interesting bonds out there. Also, the bull run has some leading stocks with historically high valuations, maybe making long-only positions a little riskier. So what to do? I think the answer is flexibility. The market may keep going higher. It may not. It could even go down. Is fixed income a thought for some part of the portfolio? Rates are not zero anymore. You may want to protect some gains. Think about some rebalancing, address some growing concentration issues, maybe thinking about commodities. We at PTI may have a solution just right for you. Open an account at PTI Pro Direct, PTI's online trading platform using the Interactive Broker high-end platform. There you will find competitive rates and solid execution across all product lines and traditionally high interest on money balances. In addition, at any time you can seamlessly decide for fixed income investments to access Dan Janitas at Kratos Capital for management services. Dan and his team work tirelessly to achieve the highest returns they can, whatever risk category you are comfortable with. You can also quickly access my team for investment services and a wide array of investment strategies on the security or commodity side, protective strategies, concentration issues, or straight long. In one place, you'll be able to be flexible and ride whatever the future market holds with people you are used to hearing and trusting every day. Need help? You got it. Don't need help? That's okay, too. You'll have a great self-management platform with help always available. This market can change on a dime. I believe, like everyone else, having the right people there if needed is the way to go. Call me at 312-663-4310 or email me at time@ptisecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom, Ricky on the board. S&P Futures up 13. NASDAQ Futures up 105. We have to do that every day. We have NVIDIA up 239, another what, $60 billion in market cap just hanging around on a Tuesday morning without any kind of problem. Top 62 individual stocks that had earnings. United Health came out a little bit negative. They're down 650. Merck came out and said they're going to cut a whole bunch of expenses. They're down 329. It's almost 4% on the Merck. So a couple of these. Boeing came out. They're up $3. It's 1%, so pretty good on the Boeing side. Over in Asia, we have the Asia-Pacific markets are mixed. Nikkei down 323.8%. Hang Seng down 37.1%. Shanghai up 11.3%. So not much going on over there. Nikkei down, you know, reasonable amount. Over in Europe, DAX up 266, 1.1. The FTSE up 45.5%. CAC around up 92, 1.2. Philips shares up 10% as health tech giant flags reduced U.S. tariff impact. I don't know why there's any impact, but we have tariffs now. We're talking about they're being reduced. It's kind of crazy. Bonds unchanged, 2.69 to 10-year. Japan unchanged as well. Oil, 35 cents, 67.06, kind of mired in this let's say between 65 and 68 here. Brent up 32 cents, 70.36. Natural gas up 9 cents, 3.08, back up over 3 bucks. RBOB is up a penny, 2.14. We've got gold, which has been getting its butt kicked. Today's bouncing a little bit, up 10.30, 33.20. Silver up 6 cents, 38.28. Copper up a penny, 5.63. So staying above this 5.60 number, which is where tariffs drove it from 5, it still was the trade of the year so far. Foreign exchange, euro's down to 1.15. It was 1.17 a couple of weeks ago. So that's been a big boost in the dollar here. Pound 133, it made it up to 135. So the dollar's been strong. Crypto, Bitcoin is up 981, 118, 898. Ricky, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports, and again, poor Rhino. My boy, that's sad.
Morning, Chief. It's currently 7:36 a.m. here in Chicago. We're looking at 74 degrees right now with a high of 89. A thunderstorm this morning, probably. Otherwise, very warm and humid with clouds giving way to some sun. Tonight will be partly cloudy, warm, and humid with a low of 74 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 89 degrees right now with a high of 111. However, with plenty of sunshine, danger of dehydration and heat stroke if outside for too long. Tonight will be clear with a low of 86 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, Kennedy from Monroe is 32 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lane Cook, 47 minutes. We're looking at 35 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, Dan Ryan from 95th, 19 minutes. And lastly, inbound Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan, 33 minutes. Let's talk sports. Yesterday, White Sox beat Phillies 6-2, but Diamondbacks lose to Tigers 1-5, and Cubs lose to Brewers 4-8. Today we have back-to-back games. Diamondbacks at Tigers 5:40 p.m., Cubs at Brewers 6:40 p.m., and Phillies at White Sox 6:40 p.m. Back over to you guys.
I mean, we're looking around, and this is so reminiscent of, you know, it's like the mirror part of the what is it, physics? Every action has another, an equal and opposite reaction. When I first started, that's why this is so weird to me. The market was like 800, interest rates were to the moon, and you saw things just kind of starting to change because people were so locked into putting their money in a bank, getting 12% and 15% at the thought of putting anything in the market. Yet I'm sitting there going, boy, this looks to me like if there's going to be a breakout, it's going to be the upside, not, you know, down so low, it's starting to look like up. But it took, from the time I started, it took a solid 18 months. So you can't, you know, guys like us can't sit there and go, God, the market looks like it's getting ahead of itself. These valuations, you can't sit there and buy puts or short stock this morning with the idea the rest of the world is going to read the same article and agree with you by this afternoon. I mean, it takes forever, and a lot of times when the change happens, it happens in such a way where you never saw that one coming. So even if you're sort of looking at the numbers and saying, you know, we're stretched here, we could grow into it, we could not grow into it, there could be a crisis and all of a sudden this revaluation could happen, or it never happens and the economy continues to putter along, maybe it gets a little better, and we grow into it, that could happen. You never really know. You can't predict, you know, the outcome. It's like if you have a really good baseball team and you think you're going to kick these guys ass, you think something good's going to happen, but you can't point a finger at the guy and he's going to get the key hit, right? You just never know.
Yeah, well, I think the new paradigm is this Warner/post-Keynesian model of money creation, and I think we're seeing it right now. Milton Friedman argued that money supply was a vertical line, meaning the Fed can't control how much money supply is in the system. The post-Keynesian money supply model is where money supply is a perfectly flat, elastic curve set at whatever interest rate the central bank imposes. And I think what's going on now is when the Fed raises the interest rate, it probably squeezes lending a little bit, holding everything else constant. But when it lowers it, it probably induces these banks, these individual banks, to make loans out of thin air. They're just making loans like Werner observed. And what that does is it creates a moral hazard. Banks, when interest rates are really, really low, banks will just make a ton of loans. And they know that these loans are going to be backfilled by reserves that the Federal Reserve can print. So you have the two components here. You have this arbitrage where a bank makes a loan at, you know, 7% to an institutional investor or somebody, you know, using the money to make stock purchases or buy X, right? And then they're going to borrow that money from the central bank at whatever the interbank rate is, in our case, the Federal Reserve rate. So you have this arbitrage and you have this moral hazard. And I think the post-Keynesians and my former colleague...
What is a post-Keynesian?
Is a reinterpretation of Keynes's models. And with regard to money supply, they see the money supply curve as being a flat line at whatever interest rate the central bank sets. Whereas,
well, that's BS.
A monetarist views the money supply as a vertical line at the quantity that the Federal Reserve determines. And that's really the difference.
Well,
they
sort of determine. I mean, they target.
Yeah, but in the monetarist models and the neoclassical models, money supply is a vertical line because they're assuming that most of the money that is in the system is created by the central bank. But a post-Keynesian understands that when the Fed sets an interest rate, like a discount rate or a federal funds rate or interest on reserves rate, that it flattens the money supply curve.
Why do people, even serious economists like yourself, why is everybody in the habit now? If you listen to TV, it's like I was talking to Kenny. Why is everybody in the habit of talking about this rate when it's really not the issue? I mean, when I say this,
it's actually the issue because when the rate is low and money demand is high.
No, I'm talking about
banks just make loans.
I'm talking about the way of interpreting this. I mean, what Hal's saying is 100% accurate, by the way, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I'm giving you the A paper here.
Oh, it's not me. It's Werner and it's post-Keynesian.
But you knew this before you read him. I mean, what the Fed is doing, and I don't know why we've turned the nomenclature around, is like, you know, what Trump's talking about is that they should drop this thing dramatically. Now, if Trump maybe he does.
Well, you got to remember Trump.
Okay, but what
is
I'm saying is, what?
For, Tom, you got to remember that Trump.
I'm just trying to do the process.
He's leveraging
here.
Crazy.
I know, but I'm
lowering the interest rate to 1.5 is crazy because he wants the Fed to move a little bit, like with a 25 or 50 basis point.
Okay.
Cut right.
So
he leverages crazy.
Well, when somehow regular people, don't understand that when you talk about the federal funds rate, what Hal has been talking about here all ties together. I mean, it's obviously more than a 10-minute show. It all ties together. When he's talking about if the banks are pushing this credit out there, I mean, not pushing it, but if people are coming to
them,
people are coming to them for loans, and the loans are stacking up.
Yeah, there's demand for loans,
right? And because the reserve requirement is now zero,
they're simply accommodating. They're simply accommodating.
They're
kind of that.
Yeah, they're not doing anything untoward. They're not doing anything like that. But if a bank starts loaning a little too much, guess what? They're short on reserves, right? So they have to go to another bank.
They don't care because the Fed will backfill.
What I'm
money.
Saying, they can go to
They'll
another bank. They can go to another bank. Northern Trust gives out too many big loans today. They can go to Citibank and borrow.
Or, Tom, they can just go to the Fed the reserves.
They still use the term federal funds rate.
Yeah.
When you go to the Fed, that was a sign of a bad boy. That means
you got to remember, Tom, the federal funds rate is equal to the interest rate on reserves, so they can go to either one.
My point is, the banking system is supposed to handle it themselves.
Yeah.
And when you're supposed to go to Citi and borrow the money, if you went to the discount window and got the money, what it said was you weren't handling yourself right. For years, banks never got a discount rate loan because it was considered bad management. They would go from bank to bank. So if they decided that they wanted interest rates, say, to go up, they would withdraw money from the system. So the next night, Northern Trust goes to Citigroup and said, oh, no, the rate's not 4.2, it's 4.3 overnight. Now, but it's a big difference to a bank when you're talking about $500 million or something, right? So that's what they do. They monitor the money. So it's not – they will – if they say they want to go the federal funds rate from 4.5 to 4, what they do is start pulling money out of the – I'm sorry, from 4.5 to 4. They're putting money in the system every day until it gets easier and easier to do this loan every night to where you call up the Citibank and you go, guys, we're down to 4. That's what they're doing. The action happens before the rate movement is all I'm trying to say. Correct?
Well, like, for example, if Bank of America made $1 billion in irresponsible loans at the federal funds rate, which is equal to the interest rate on reserves, and it didn't have the reserves it didn't have the balances at all.
Yeah, but you got to
find the Fed will just give them – the Fed will just print the money
They will – they could go now to the discount window, which you say is used more than it used to be. It never used to be used at all because that was a bad boy bank. But when you say irresponsible loans, if the loan is too big where you don't have enough reserves for it, then the bank has to go and borrow that money. But irresponsible doesn't mean a bad loan. I mean, if they make $1 million bad loan, they're writing it off. That has nothing to do with the Fed.
No, I'm not talking about bad loans. Yeah. I'm talking about where
they exceeded their reserves, their reserve ability.
I'm not talking about exceeding the reserves. What I'm saying is, when interest rates are set by markets, only the projects that are profitable at that interest rate are made.
In theory, right?
Only those loans are made.
In theory,
but when the Fed comes in and sets interest rates well below that market rate of interest, all these projects that would have been discarded had the ceiling not been set by the Fed, all those projects get funded.
Right.
And that is what Austrians call malinvestment.
Without a doubt.
And those malinvestments are revealed when rates go up, because now all of a sudden, all those projects, they don't have the cash to pay those loans. So they go under, right? So we see the malinvestments.
But it gets worse, because some people can borrow at this ridiculous rate, most of us can't.
Yeah.
So if Amazon wants to get in the plumbing business, they'll be out and be able to get plumbing trucks at 3%. If you and I want to get in the plumbing business, I guess it's on our credit. It's on our credit card, right? At 30.
Yeah.
Well, that's a problem. You know, I mean, all the people I was talking about earlier that are, the bankruptcies and small businesses and the farmers, the small farms that are these. They're not 2%, are they? Or 3%? I doubt.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of the farm aid nowadays has to do with artificially set low interest rates. I think a lot of the farm aid. I was reading on the farm aid because the federal government used to buy all kinds of surplus product to push prices up because they wanted to save the family farm. So they would buy a bunch of milk to essentially set the price of milk at a price higher than the market rate, and they would end up with all this dehydrated milk. And they have warehouses throughout the United States. They have like 9,000 warehouses throughout the United States where they store grain and whatnot. It's very Babylonian, right? Ancient Babylon.
Well, we used to.
But nowadays,
I think
most of their aid is in the form of interest rates.
We were in the schools. We would get surplus flour, surplus sugar, and surplus cheese. The cheese was good. Get these huge 10-pound blocks of cheese.
Yeah, we ate the 2-foot-long, 4x4-inch block of cheese. It was like, when I was a kid, it seemed like the biggest block of cheese of all time. And, the funny thing is it never molded. We always say
that. Well, isn't cheese sort of mold to start with? I mean, Well, some of it is, I guess. Don't they, for the really good cheese, don't they cut the mold off and sell you to restaurants? I'm not a dairy
guy. In France, the funny thing about raw milk is, I was reading about raw milk, because everybody in the United States thinks raw milk is not very good for you and is very unhealthy. But in France, the highest quality cheeses and the highest quality milk are made from unpasteurized raw milk. And the French consider the kind of moldy parts of the cheese to be the best parts, right? And when you get to the edge of the cheese, it gets harder. The center of the cheese is usually creamier. But the edge of the cheese is where it's, I guess, aged the most or something. And an American would probably cut that part out and just eat the center of the cheese, because it get nice and gooey and soft, right?
Well, unless you use the Italian stuff where you put it in the grinder and grind it up. The hard cheese.
Yeah. But if you go to a French, if you're in a French hotel and you're having their, I guess, their continental breakfast, it's usually just really thick maple syrup style coffee and cheeses with like different kinds of bread. Well, that's pretty much the breakfast.
That's because a guy like you's hanging around in the French hotels. Rest of us.
Well, I went there once. My wife and I went there on our honeymoon, and we were there for a week, and that's what we had for breakfast every day.
We had to keep your strength up.
Well, that coffee that I drank kept me awake all day. I mean, it had the consistency of maple syrup, and it was strong.
One thing I thought in Europe really sucked. If you go to breakfast, you get a cup of coffee. You get another cup, it's another $2. The idea that the bottomless cup is not a concept.
They probably have a half a pound of grounds in that one cup of coffee, right?
Well, maybe, but I mean, the idea of the second cup's another charge.
Well, I think that that coffee in France, they use the amount of grounds I use in a pot of coffee for one cup of coffee. It was powerful.
You're
stuff,
saying it was
man.
Really espresso in that coffee.
Oh, I think it was more than espresso. It was maple syrup. I like my coffee, you know, strong, but not that strong.
What do you make of, I'm going to ask you the same thing I asked Hal. What do you make of, I've been following this Epstein thing. I'm trying to get it on a whole bunch of different levels. And I've been very impressed with this lady, Kathleen Webb, that somehow or another has been researching this for, I'd say she's got 2 books out on it.
Yeah.
And I was listening, and you know, like I say, there's people that just want, you know, the politicians exposed. There's people that want, you know, whoever went after a young girl exposed. They want the people to detract. There's different levels of all this, but she's kind of even higher than where I was thinking, and she's tracing this all back to like World War II.
Really?
And the connection
that doesn't surprise me at all.
Well, she's the connections between the CIA and British intelligence and the mafia and what Warner Lansky and those kinds of people, and how they helped out with the war effort and other sorts of things, and how they've never really been totally split apart. They're all still part of the intelligence community. I think
those intelligence agencies from different countries work together very well.
Yeah, and the people that have a lot of the influence are some of them. I'll use the term underworld, if they don't call it that anymore. But this is something that you and I do when we talk, Al. I don't even know if we know we do it. I know I do, because George Stigley's talking about it all the time, and I said, if I ever get like that, shoot me. Well, I'm getting like that. But I guess you don't have to shoot me just yet. But the lady says, well, why are these books like, why are you 1,000 pages into this? And she says, well, every time I hit into a bump, I get to, they're doing business through, you know, she named some bank that I recognize the name. And she said this bank was doing some of the money laundering for these people. Well, then I couldn't just leave it at that. I had to do a chapter like on this bank, because if you trace the bank all the way back, you realize what a bunch of sleazebags they are. And she said a lot of the stuff that Epstein's money and so forth leads to the same places that Iran-Contra led to.
Yeah.
With the big investigation with Dan Inouye, was the congressional investigator. What did Dan Inouye say? It was the biggest threat to the Constitution he ever saw?
Well, I don't think Iran-Contra was the only illegal arms.
What I'm saying is, her point is, the same way of moving cash around to avoid or to evade everything are the same people, the same banks.
I'm convinced these Hollywood movies, like they were during the 1940s and 50s, they were propaganda films for the war effort, right?
Well, some were, yeah.
I mean, they really, you know, they made war, you know, a fun thing and a patriotic thing. And I think these, I don't think Hollywood's changed. When you watch the Bourne movies, I think they're over-exaggerating what really goes on. These Swiss bank accounts.
Did you read the book?
I didn't read the book, huh?
Well, there's three of them, but I read them all.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting. I mean,
I think they reflect reality to some extent.
Well, right? if you look at the one it is exactly, I won't say exactly word for word, but not the new one. If you can get the one on tape, I'll show my age. See the original Day of the Jackal, or read the book.
Yeah,
it is fascinating.
Yeah,
or the one with the what's the Dogs of War? It's not about guys going to to take over some little country in Africa. The procurement of machine guns, the procurement of this, the getting the ship, getting this. Procuring the rafts that you're going to sneak aboard on tonight, the black rafts the SEALs use. Procuring all that stuff without anybody knowing you're doing it. I mean, the Day of the Jackal had to do it, and it's kind of similar to what, you know, the CIA, it's almost a mirror image of the CIA's being pissed off at Kennedy for the Bay of Pigs.
Yeah.
Or
wanting to close down the CIA.
Yeah, well, yeah, because he realized what was happening. But what happened with the French, and I don't know that much about this. Jimmy, actually, producer yesterday, pretty big history buff when it comes to the Middle East, and I'm not. When we talked yesterday, I don't know if you listened to it. What I'd like to, if I could have a Hal who knows a whole bunch of stuff, I would actually take two or three Saturdays, and go for 5 hours of class and learn about the history of the Middle East, and how the Ottoman Empire fell apart after World War I or even before. And then all of a sudden the French and the Brits and everybody came in there and like chucked the place up and made borders, did all kinds of crazy stuff that we're still having problems with today, right? To be perfectly honest. Well, part of that was the French were involved there, and the French Foreign Legion got involved in some of these French, would you call them colonies, Hal, or whatever? And the
like Djibouti, Africa. We went there in the Navy.
But they ended up essentially having, some people have accused the CIA of getting the poppy trade going again in Afghanistan when the Taliban had actually knocked it out. I mean, I don't know if that's true or not, but you've heard that they essentially derived their own sources of funding, where if Trump tomorrow said he's cutting 25% of the CIA, they'd be pissed, but not that pissed, if you believe this stuff. And so the French Foreign Legion, de Gaulle basically disbanded them. And those guys were pissed. And they made how many different assassination attempts on de Gaulle. I'm going to try and research this, but according to the book, it was like 3 or 4. And that's why he would only ride...
It's like the CIA taking out those people in the 1960s, yeah. Right?
Well, that's why de Gaulle, being the goofball that he was, would only ride in a Citroen. Because he'd got shot so many times in a Citroen, and he never got killed. It was his lucky car. And so he ended up, these guys, whoever they were, these Foreign Legion dudes, hired the Jackal to kill de Gaulle. So it's sort of like a mirror image of CIA being pissed off about the Bay of Pigs thing and all that kind of... I mean, it's hard to get this all together because it's all so long ago, but it's kind of the same thing, right? It's people here that are pissed off at policy change.
I was listening to a podcast about Keynes, and back when Europe was very Christian, where people had to either be Christian or they had to appear to be Christian, and appear to be like heterosexual, married to their wife that they loved. There was lots of behaviors that didn't comport to that. And I mean, when you talk about MI6 and the CIA kind of like being founded back around that time, the war period or the interwar period, all those foundations were laid. I can see them using it as a way to steer policy in the way they want it steered, using compromising situations and blackmail, right? I mean, I think that's the reason why you have the Epstein program.
I'm with you.
It really, to me, is about making sure that you get the policy that you want, you get the court case that you want. When you look at the Pelican Brief book and the movie, right? You want the court to rule in a certain way. Well, how do you do that? Well, you can take them out, or it can just simply have compromising information on them that they don't want out. So, to me, it aligns with what Hollywood is producing. And Hollywood, in my opinion, has always been a reflection of what's going on. I mean, it's over-exaggerated.
Well, a lot of people in Hollywood were the informers during the Second World War because
they were the pilots. They were the paratroopers, right? They were the troops. They were in the media, the Army's media operation.
Well, they also were the people traveling around Europe doing the what do they call them, the whatever the shows they used to call them.
USO.
But they also were staying in the hotels and drinking in the bars where everybody was.
Yeah.
Just told them to listen up. You hear anything, call us. All right, so what do you think? We stay long this week, or how long are we staying long?
Oh, I think you stay long because I think the Fed it has no interest in popping bubbles. And you got bubbles everywhere. You got bubbles in stock market. You got bubbles in real estate. You got bubbles in crypto. I don't think they want to pop bubbles. And if they lower interest rates, there's going to be more money creation. So
if they don't pop it someday, I don't think we're going to be 5 years from now still sitting here 1% a day going up in the NASDAQ.
I think one of the reasons why interest rates are being kind of held high by Powell right now is because they know if they lower interest rates, there's going to be more of this money creation in bank lending.
What's it going to do in the long term? I think if he lowers rates in the short term, all he's going to do is push them up in the long term.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Anyway, buddy.
I mean, he'll eventually have to raise them back up.
What do you got going this weekend? Anything good?
I'm just building up my history of economic theory class.
All right. Well, we need to. Every week I threaten to dig through my stuff, see if I can find some stuff. But if you're gonna go back to Babylon, you might want to look at Rome. They were the first people to degrade.
Oh yeah.
To degrade
I'm working
the
my way through history.
All right, buddy. SP Futures up 11. NASDAQ Futures up 86. Ricky, nice job. Back tomorrow. Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.